Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. You guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, January 7th, 2018. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like the show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival, and you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 256. I have a super special return guest, comedian, podcaster, king of unpaid media, J.L. Covan. You know him, you love him, and he's back on the show today. This week, rather. Today I'm uploading it. You get the picture. Your good friend J.L. Covan's back on the show, and I'm excited to share my conversation with him, with you. Right now, I'm gonna do that in a bit, but right now I'm gonna talk to you. I've got the Buffalo Bills and Jacksonville Jaguars game on mute. The Bills are losing. Nobody's catching the ball for Tyrod Taylor. He's one of my two only hopes. I have two hopes for black quarterbacks. I only have two options. I have Tyrod Taylor. This isn't looking good. And I've got Cam Newton against the Saints. I really haven't been following much football this year, not because of protests. It's just because it's kind of fucking boring now. So I don't know. You can tell that my interest in football has waned if on a Sunday afternoon I go see, and one Sunday I went to go see Lady Bird. So I hope everyone had a good first week of the new year. I hope everybody had a safe and happy holiday. I hope this finds you doing well. I had a pretty good New Year's Eve. I did a show in Highland, New York, which is near SUNY New Paltz and Poughkeepsie, like that area, at the Rocking Horse Ranch and Resort. It's like a dude ranch place where families can go, and I think you can pet and ride horses, and they have swimming and skiing and shit up there. It was really cold up there. It was like negative 11. It was insane. And I did a show there. I had fun. It was a little shaky in some parts because I talked about our president. But it wasn't. Well, I do say that I'm ashamed of the country and part of my set. But overall, it was fine. I had a good time. And it was good to do some stand up on New Year's Eve. But I didn't really do any part. I'm not a party guy anyway, so I didn't really. I was gonna watch the ball drop, and it's like 11:55. I was looking at my laptop. I was in the bed, and then I think I closed my eyes for a little bit, and when I woke up, it was 12:04, and I think I just went to bed. Man, the Bills are not doing anything for this. I hope he goes somewhere else and plays with a team that just respects him, because this shit is fucking ridiculous. It just makes me, I don't even know if they'd even deserve to be. I don't know, man. So that was cool. I had fun doing that. I had a show at Gotham Comedy Live. Gotham Comedy Club. Gotham Comedy Live was the show. At a show at Gotham Comedy Club in the Vintage Lounge on this past Wednesday. That was a lot of fun. That place is, the Vintage Lounge is becoming my favorite place to perform. That show was sold out. It was right before the bomb cyclone that happened on the East Coast, in the Northeast. And it was so cool. It was so great. Like, I didn't have to go to work. It snowed. Everybody got snowed in. Didn't have to go to work the next day on Thursday. And it was just a good time. Like, I riffed with them for a little bit. And polished off some stuff that I was trying to see if it still worked, and did a little bit of. I just had a fun time, you guys. It was fun. So I'm looking forward to more spots this year, just to build up the act. So I had a good time. I don't know when the next show. I have a show August 5th. August 5th, Jesus Christ, Chris. April 5th at Steel Stacks in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I'm headlining. I think I'm headlining a show out there, one of my places that I get to go to about every other year, every 2 years or so. Always like going out there. So that, put that on your calendar. It's a Thursday night. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So if you're in that region and you want to see me do some stand-up, do a long set, come to that. But I think there's some other stuff maybe in Connecticut that's coming up soon. They're still working on that shit. So hopefully there'll be more dates, and I'll tweet them out when that time comes. I want to read a review. I got a review, guys. How about that? I'm up to 41 reviews now. There was one that was on December 26th that I'll read to you. This said, the title of this is called "Chris Ruined Hack Comedy for Me." And this is by Jay Full. This review is long overdue. I don't even know how long I've been listening. It seems like forever. At least back when he had a weird Twitter handle. I've always had the same Twitter handle. So he says, or was it Tumblr? I think it was Tumblr because the Tumblr page was called Mundane Festival at one point. This podcast is a weekly staple in my queue. The inside baseball comedy talk has ruined comedy for me. Now my laugh standards are so much higher, which is definitely a good thing. Sometimes I can see where these whack comedians' jokes are headed, and I end up eye-rolling. Hopefully Chris can do an LA show, and I can check out his comedy live. I always enjoy him on the many podcasts he guest stars on. Thanks so much, Jayful. That makes me feel good. It makes me feel like I'm not just throwing this thing out into the abyss. So thanks. What else? I just saw this commercial. All these cable companies like try to threaten that they're getting rid of a channel. And so for the past couple of weeks, it's been Stars. Fios, it doesn't seem to have that problem since I've had them for the past, I want to say, 4 years or so. But they're... And this one is like, Optimum's getting rid of Stars. And the whole thing was just like power, because they know black people like power so much. So it's like, niggas, y'all want y'all power, right? Then if y'all don't step up, y'all don't do what y'all supposed to do. Do you have to contact your congressman for them to keep power on, to keep Stars on? It's so fucking weird. These power struggles that these super rich people have. And the working people busting their ass to make these payments, these super fucking expensive payments to just so they can we watch Omari Hardwick? Can we watch, you know, the fucking show, man? The Latin girl take her top off, and the shitty, what's his shitty kid's name? I can't even think of the shitty Tariq, the asshole kid. Like, you know, we want to see what happens, you know? So they're really trying to appeal to black people. Y'all know. I don't know. It's just funny to me. What else? I think that's pretty much. I didn't really like. It's been so cold. I haven't really gone. I just gone out to run errands, like picking up my dry cleaning. I went to get some Long Johns yesterday, some thermal underwear, and. I was going to go to like Casual Mail, like Big and Tall, but they didn't have any. So I called the Army Navy surplus store that's near me. And so they just had like one pair left. And I was like, oh, so are you guys going to get some more? And they were like, no, we're closing down. She's like, I'm closing up. I've been here 47 years. And she was like talking about how Amazon's just taken over everything, which is true, because you can just order something on Amazon and they send it right to you. Even if it's through another retailer, they'll send it to you. And she said kids just come into the store and take pictures of shit and then they order it on Amazon. I guess because it's cheaper, but it's like the shit is sitting right in front of you. Why don't you just, I don't know, man. So it goes. When I was snowed in on Thursday and all I did was like look at, I did some podcasts and stuff, but I like was looking at action figures, like the new Black Panther action figures and shit. So I ordered a Black Panther Marvel Legends. I posted a little dumb video on my Instagram. I got the Eric Killmonger figure and the Black Panther figure. And so I'm a novice comic book collector. I'm a comic book action figure collector. I have some Star Wars and some Marvel stuff. I don't really have that many. So I did that. And yeah, it's nothing much else to report on my end. It's just that I think that's it. So the Golden Globes are this tonight. I'm going to see what the aftermath of that is. And then when the Oscar noms come out, I think I will try to bug Aisha Harris and try to get her back on and discuss some Oscar stuff. I've got some indie movie corner stuff going. Look, guys, so here's the thing. I've recorded a bunch of indie movie corners, some reviews and whatnot. And I'll continue to post more and more this award season. Subscribe. Look, it's not just movie reviews. So there's more than just movie reviews on the Patreon page. There's episode like Randolph Terrence is on a special episode. There's a couple just Lucy's with me talking. You like me talking. I'm on there. Was this one with Mike Brown and I where we talk about Paris Games Week, but we're mainly just talking about the new The Last of Us Part 2 trailer that got released a couple months ago. We talk theories on that. I'm in talks to have someone, a special return guest that has universal acclaim. I'm in talks with a person to come back on the show. And that's probably most likely going to be on Patreon if this person decides to return my text. And I know that person's very busy. I love that person. And the person's very talented. And that person is in high demand. So if I can get some time with that person again, it would be incredible. And you will have another great episode with that special guest. I'm not going to tell you who he or she is because I don't want you to say, well, you said you was going to get Usher on the show. Like, I'm not going to do that. You know, you said you was going to get this person. So I'm just putting that out in the universe that person you would enjoy this person on the show, on the special show, talking about something in the cultural universe / zeitgeist, if you will. So anyway, there's cool shit going on. And the movie reviews, they're more than just movie reviews. I tell childhood stories on some of them. There's funny shit that happens. Jeff Cerulli is my unofficial co-host. He's great. And I'm going to have some more of those that come up. So it's cool shit. Like, it's $3. And I think there's some you can donate however much you want. And you could say, Chris, I like your show, but I don't give a fuck about your movie reviews. Here's $1. I'll take that, too. It makes the show better. It could help get more cool equipment and stuff to just enhance the already amazing podcast that you get every week. So that's my song and dance for the Patreon page. A lot of cool stuff going on over there. And there's more to come, especially now. During award season. So that is happening. And let's just get you to JL. So JL is a good buddy of mine. And we were initially just, he's the latest episode of Indie Movie Corner, where we talk about The Shape of Water. And we were just initially going to talk about Shape of Water. And we started talking about other stuff. I said, hey, why don't we just, we talk about The Shape of Water, but then let's just catch up and see where we get. And it turned out that we had a beefy episode. There was a sound issue during a part of the episode, so I had to edit some stuff. But this is a heavy comedy episode. And a couple things before I share this with you. So we talked about the Dave Chappelle special. And after we talked, I was re-listening to this episode. And I was thinking about Dave Chappelle's, I was thinking about Equanimity. And I think it's a great special. One of the things that pissed me out about the backlash from Dave Chappelle's special, not necessarily the think pieces, because think pieces are going to happen regardless. Think pieces, they're going to think. They're going to be out there. What was troubling to me is that other comedians were trying to police and censor what another comic was saying. And the comedy, you're supposed to be able to say whatever you want. You're supposed to be able to say it. But you're supposed to have license to say whatever you want. Now, whether people laugh or not, or whether people continue to buy tickets or support you after you say the things that you say, that goes part and parcel with that, you know. I mean, I almost think that goes without saying. We say, oh, I don't really like his stance or his take on this. I don't like that joke. Maybe that's enough for me to not want to buy a ticket or watch the special, blah, blah, blah. And I can totally understand that. But when other comics are trying to be self-righteous and sanctimonious about what another comic says, it's a little troublesome to me, because, you know, you're supposed to be able to have everything at your disposal, and then you have to talk about whatever you want, and then to filter it in a way with your point of view, to have a unique point of view, make it funny and palatable for a general audience. I mean, I think that's what the process is. At least that's the way that I see it. And however you do that, if you're getting the laugh, then more power to you. So it's like you can have a comic that you disagree with, and when the fact that they make you laugh, I think that's pretty cool. That's the magic. That's the fun. The fun of it all. And I think Dave Chappelle does it well. I thought Patrice O'Neill did it really well. I think Bill Burr does it well too, and Louis C.K. did it too. And I know that, and now that he's in the shadows right now. But yeah, that was something that bothered me. And then I will say this: what I rewatched Equanimity again, and I was thinking about that, the structure of his special, because that's one thing that I really appreciate about Dave Chappelle. He's a master at the craft. But it felt like Equanimity, where people had, like JL was talking about the ending, the if you haven't seen it, there's maybe like 7 minutes on Emmett Till and the aftermath of what happened. And I'm not going to ruin the joke, but his thing was like, oh, it's kind of one man showy. I could see his argument for that. But when I think about it again, and when I watched it, it felt like everything from the top to the Trump stuff, that was the hour. That was it. Like, he could have ended it there. But then it was almost like he could have been like, okay, maybe close it in a different way and be like, I'm out, blah, blah, blah. That Emmett Till chunk kind of played to me, the more I thought about it, it kind of played to me as an encore. So if he would have said, Trump, Mac Mittens, blah, 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 get your own Mac Mittens, close it in another way. And then comes back and tells that story, ask that guy where he's from and talk about blah, blah, blah. And then that could have been like, it almost played like an encore. So it was almost like the encore was written in to that act. So that's how it played to me after I thought about it. Maybe tell me your thoughts on that. That's something that I didn't, I wasn't thinking about that when JL was talking about equanimity, but it's just something that came up as I rewatched it. We talk about some shit. We talk about comedy. We talk about our frustrations. So without further ado, here's me and the great JL Covan talking comedy. So what's the deal with Righteous Prick? Are you? Do I have to resuscitate your podcast again like I did last year?
It'll be back. It'll be back. I took some time off for the holidays. It'll be back on Tuesday the 9th.
Okay, good, good. Because the people need it, man. It's a great show. People enjoy it.
Oh, thank you.
We can't get you talking about you're gonna quit all the time. The game needs you, man. Whether you think it does or not, the game needs you.
Well, I appreciate that. I need health and happiness. So sometimes those feel like goals in conflict.
Dude, it's so hard, man. I think because we're the same age. We're about the same age. You're a year older. I'm turning 38 next month, and I realized like how sometimes at work you can get bogged down and things could just seem like a total shit show and it's meaningless, and the pettiness that you deal with at work. Obviously there's pettiness in show business to a greater level. But I was just noticing like I did a spot in the Vintage Lounge at Gotham last night, and I was driving into the city. I was just like, I need this. Like I need it. Like it's like, regardless of the fame and notoriety, like I know that as a person, I need this to combat the bullshit that I'm dealing with every day.
See, for me, I feel like comedy started as a break, as a hobby, as something cool and fun to just be creative with and get my mind off of, you know, because I started in law school.
Right.
And now it feels like when I get home and I, you know, even though Cookie, my dog, annoys me 65% of the time, you know, between my girlfriend and my dog, and I feel like that, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing when your home is your break from shit. Like, it's much better than the other way around. Like, damn, I hate being home. Thank God I have something to, like, help me ignore the people in my life. Like, that's so true. It's good that is the positive or the more positive, but like, you know, I've gotten to the point now where, and I'm, you know, I'm planning on a new album this year. And so I will get back into open mics and trying to get booked on shows in New York. But for a lot of 2017, I just basically did road work and made some videos and did some impressions, and that was it. Like I barely went out in the city this year because I get home. And if I've hit the gym, if I've been, you know, motivated enough to hit the gym at like 6:30 in the morning, go to work for 10 hours, I just want to get home. Like, I don't want to do a mic. I don't want to be in the comedy scene. Now, that hasn't stopped me from writing and from, you know, working on stuff, especially on the road, you know, maybe 20 new minutes, five new minutes if I have stuff. Because the road is good. You get 6-7 shows in a week.
Yeah.
And you can sort of build up some material. But it's gotten to the point where comedy now feels more the obligation than the break or the enjoyment, which is a problem because, like, when I get home, I'm like, nope, I'm happy to be home, or I'm happier to be home than outside.
I'm the same way.
Go ahead. No, that's all.
I was feeling like that yesterday because I want, as happy as I was to do a spot last night, I was trying to prep for the snowstorm and what do they call this? The bomb cyclone? I was trying to prep for that. So after work, normally I would go see a movie and then I'd see a movie in Westchester, out in Port Chester actually, which is in Westchester. Fucking redundant. But anyway, I would go after that and go do the spot and come home. Yesterday I went to the grocery store and then went home, took a nap, and then went back out, and I was just kind of dreading coming back home because of parking. I was like worried about that shit. But then, like, once I kind of like shook my routine up because I didn't go see a movie. But I don't know, man. It's hard to figure that out, because last year for me, 2017 was actually getting acting work, the thing that I wanted to do ever since I was a kid. That was happening, and it seemed like I was getting more respect from people that were important in that field, and not really. And I was like, oh yeah, I do this, and I am good at this. And I mentioned this on this show before, but I was doing a scene on a TV show, and I was just starting to get comfortable with performing. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of like I haven't been doing it for a long time. And thankfully, with you, I've been able to get to act a little bit, and you know, spread my wings. But and
there will be some goals before you become, you know, a SAG star that needs me to get you to sign a waiver to be in my sketches. There is some quality content in the pipelines, February through May, I'd say, of this year from me.
Okay, we'll talk about that off mic.
But
you know, and I was on set, and I was doing my job like throughout the whole year, but I just started to get a little bit more comfortable, and I asked the director, I said, "Hey, was that okay?" And she said, "Chris, I would have told you if you didn't do it right."
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I know we're all Me Too now, but come on, man.
Hey, man. See, I know you're joking, but I do that shit too a lot. But for me, much of my life has been having female teachers, female bosses. So I never really was like, you know, I have a mom that's a taskmaster. So I was just kind of like, oh, okay, you're in control. It is what it is. That's been like a thing of normalcy throughout all my life. So
yeah,
I don't know. And I guess we'll get into that a little bit later when we talk about the movie. But yeah, it's sort of a thing. I felt like last year was a transitional year for me. And
that's good.
Yeah, and I'm trying to see what, like, I have to dig deep and figure some more shit out about myself, and then try to better myself so I can be a better artist and a better person. But I think stand up mainly has like forced me to be really introspective within the last 9 years that I've been doing it, and it's helped me. Like, I had a moment the last two holidays being home, I was like, oh, that's why I'm a comedian. Oh. You know, just being around my parents, it's just like, oh yeah. Like, I had a good childhood and everything. I had all my needs and most of my wants satisfied, but it was just sort of like, oh yeah, the way your mother says something to you, and it's like,
right.
oh yeah, that's why. Oh yeah. So that's been pretty eye opening for me, and I'm trying to investigate that more. Do you ever have moments like that where you notice certain things about yourself, like that you may have been asleep to, like you haven't been cognizant of it?
I think that since we're talking about moms, I think the two things that I can link directly to my mother is I've been funny since I was a kid, and as I've gotten older, I realize that my mom is a pretty, and I don't say this in sort of a flippant way, she's a fairly miserable person, and I mean that more in the depressed sense than in the kind of like, oh, you're annoying or you're a drag. But I feel like humor, even at a young age, was the best way to sort of communicate with her and to make her happy.
Yeah.
And I think and the other thing is, I think also that consistently the happiest times in my childhood, I'd say, and there were plenty of happy times, but I know, you know, around fourth or fifth grade, my mom got a car for the first time. Mm-hmm. So we ended up driving from the Bronx to Westchester to the movie theaters, and we went like almost every weekend. And sometimes she'd take me to, you know, we'd just be up there, we'd do some shopping, she'd take me to one, she'd go, you want to see another one?
Wow.
And so sometimes we'd do double movies, and it would be like these full days where she was like not angry, not reminded of work or a fight with my dad or anything. It would just be like making her kid happy, spending the day out, so that I thought to myself, I was like, I wonder if that's why I like, not even, I like movies, but if I like going to the movies so much, because it's just kind of that, you know, it was almost subliminally put into my head that it's like a therapeutic space.
Yeah.
Like a spa, like it's a spa for dudes.
Dude.
You know, like it's...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you associate that with your mom, the good times with your mom.
Right. And it's one of those things where I remember the weirdest thing was when that shooting at The Dark Knight Rises occurred, you know, and I guess it's already, was it 2012 or 2011? 2011, I think.
Something.
You know, because I had my ticket for the morning, like the first morning show. Mm-hmm. But I wake up to the news and they're like, at 10 o'clock shows last night or whatever, a dude killed 12 people in Colorado at The Dark Knight Rises. And I remember for the first time ever just feeling kind of like creeped out at a movie theater. Like I wasn't comfortable. And I know that sounds weird. Like, it's not like I thought I was going to get shot, but it was one of those things where you're like, and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when the shooting, I mean, the multiple shootings, there was in South Carolina and then the one in Texas, like when your church gets shot up or people get murdered in church, you go, even there, like that's supposed to, that's like a sanctuary. Like that's literally like a place where people go to feel good and feel safe and feel kind of nourished spiritually. And you're like, wow, that would make church very difficult like the next week if you're like, yeah, the 20 people got murdered here.
Yeah.
Last week or last month. And the movie theater was kind of the same thing where I was like, I mean, anybody, I guess, could be a killer in here, but I, you know, you just assume you play the odds, obviously.
Right.
But that was just a weird, I remember just sitting watching The Dark Knight Rises and just being like, this isn't, I'm not as hyped up as I thought I'd be because of what just happened. Mm-hmm. Cause that's not like some random, like a gun went off or it was like, no, a dude went in there with like tactical gear and started killing people.
Yeah. Yeah. We're America is slowly, well, not really slowly. We're becoming one of those places where shit happens, like where a coffee shop could explode or just anything could happen and shit that you see in these, you see on the news every other morning, but it's happening here. And it's just you, but, and at the same time, you still have to live your life. And my mom is one of those people, be careful. Like, it's like, mom, I got to live my life. I got to go do this set for free, you know?
Right.
But it's definitely one of those things, but I think movies are like, there's a sort of, reverence that I have when it comes to going to the movies. Like I want to be there when the trailers start. I want to sit there and enjoy, you know, enjoy it. Take my mind. Maybe I said this to you or I've said it on the show before. Like I've come to the realization recently where I would just say the movies are my six pack. Like after a long day of work,
right.
I want to go and see a movie and it's nothing. It's nothing like it for me. Like it's one of my favorite pastimes where it's just like, I got through this day and 4:30 I'm going to go see. And like literally, I talked about this on the show, but I keep saying that there should be a drinking game. Last week I went to go see Molly's game and near my place there, we have the Garden State Plaza Mall, which is apparently the largest mall in New Jersey. And it was right after Christmas. It was maybe the 27th or the 28th of December. And it was packed. Like it was usually there's a place where you can, yeah, you might have to park a long ways off, but you're by the theater. I had to park in another section of the mall that I'd never parked in before. And I was getting angry. I was driving around. Sure. I was driving around just livid. And I said, you know what? No, I'm not going to let this ruin the one thing that I can get enjoyment out of right now. I'm going to go park at a far away. I'm going to walk and I'm going to go see Molly's game. And you're not like, they're not taking that away from me, you know? I don't know. So, we're going to get into some other stuff, but I want to talk to you about the Dave Chappelle specials that just came out, Equanimity and the Bird Revelation. I thought like, I'll just go on record and say, I really enjoyed them. I kind of watched them. I think I watched them twice in one day, and really enjoyed them. What I'm not enjoying are the think pieces. The think pieces to me, I mean, your work can be critiqued, but one of the things, that's one thing. And then another thing is comedians trying to dictate or trying to police what another comedian says. And that chaps my ass, JL. What are your thoughts?
Sure. Well, I don't know if I've ever, I don't think I've ever questioned the content choices of a comedian in terms of what material they do, what topics they discuss, what language they use. Like I use, you know, that's, I've often said I give a very wide berth to whatever comedians want to talk about, because a good comedian can make just about anything funny.
Right.
And a bad comedian can make just about anything unfunny. But with Chappelle, my only criticism, because my criticism is not to say, as many people have said, it's transphobic, or it's or the Me Too movement, he's dismissive of it. I didn't even give that a thought. Like I just laughed and moved on.
Right.
My only critique, I guess, that I was talking about was, you know me, my reflexes go in whenever I see universal acclaim from the comedy world, a community that I have.
You have a sordid relationship.
Fairly low respect for as an entity.
I understand.
I think it's comprised of mostly weak people, of people of mediocre character at best, and people who are easily swayed to just kind of join the party, whatever. Hence the Louis C.K. adoration that I, to be completely fair, still never understood. Mm-hmm. I still don't understand. Like, I will never sort of just yield and say, oh, yes. To me, I was always like, it's readily apparent to me that Bill Burr was the better comedian throughout Louis C.K.'s, you know, run as king. But that's for another day.
Well, no,
you
can sit on that for a little bit. I mean, I really
no, but it's,
I know what I like both. I like Louis and I like Burr. I think what I enjoy, you know, like you have your heroes before you start comedy, and then there's other people you start to admire while you start building your act and while you try to perfect your craft. And Bill Burr, Patrice, Louis were at the forefront for me. You know,
yeah.
And it's like what I enjoyed about them is just like enjoy about those guys was just the everyman quality. There's a heightened version of themselves when they're performing, but for the most part, they're just a guy like that's very skilled at telling,
sure,
at telling jokes. So from that standpoint, from that base, like that's something that I am trying to work out of, and it's what I enjoy about those three guys.
And what I would say is with Chappelle, it's like sometimes I only brought up something that I thought was a valid point. Like the only thing I wrote was basically everybody is acting like these specials were sort of these perfect kind of gems of comedy, and I thought they were very funny, and I enjoyed both. Like that, I always say that first. That's like my version in comedy of going like, well, I support the Me Too movement. Let me say that first off.
Yeah.
But so I enjoyed both Chappelle shows. I still think The Age of Spin was the best one he put out this year, which was earlier in the year.
Okay.
But you know, I saw somebody, I think it was Neruda, who wrote, you know, and I was being like a dick intentionally and like kind of made a joke out of it.
Yeah.
But it was like Dave Chappelle put four specials out this year and they were all amazing. I was like, well, but they were three specials made over three different years. And the fourth was basically an open mic from a talented storyteller. Like,
yeah.
So let's not, I mean, this wasn't Bring the Pain times four.
No, it wasn't.
Especially in the same year. Like they may have come out in the same year, but you know, that's a little thing. But I thought, and one of the things, and that I kind of want to write about, and I may talk about on my first episode back, is the invasion of one-man showism into stand-up comedy.
Did you feel some of those aspects in his four specials?
Yes, in the last two. In the two, because there were two very long stories that weren't funny. And I get it. You're a powerful figure in entertainment now. Like, people are going to listen to you. Like, and it's going to be entertaining. But, like, it's the same thing I thought about Neil Brennan's, which I thought was very good. But it was gimmicky also. It was an hour special that had 35 minutes of stand-up and 20-plus minutes of heartfelt stories, which make it entertaining and interesting and unique, but it also saves you from having to write 20 more minutes of A-plus humorous joke story material bits. Mm-hmm. And with Chappelle,
But you kind of lean towards the fact that, and you mentioned it, I feel like you mentioned it on Facebook, the fact that, or you either alluded to the fact that he's got his audience that's going to listen to him, so they're going to allow him to have time.
Oh, of course, yes. If I wanted to do a 10-minute bit on John Brown, the abolitionist who started the Civil War, and it had one punchline at the end of the story, people would be like, what the fuck are we listening to?
Yeah.
This is a weird closer. But it's Chappelle, so you just sort of, and that is, I think, and there's two ways of looking at that. One is that his talent and work has earned him that, which is true.
Yeah.
But I think equally true is also fans are just giving the celebrity his a chance to be a celebrity and to be in his presence, which isn't comedy. That's the same fucking portion of it. That's like, oh, I was there when Chappelle did that. And it was, very moving. And very, like, I always, I know nobody would put me on any kind of level above like solid comic who's going nowhere. But my album that I always toot the most is Keep My Enemies Closer. Now, the last bit on Keep My Enemies Closer.
That's the best thing you've ever done.
Right. And that the last bit on that album is like 9.5 minutes long about white women and why I think they disappear when every couple of years a white chick from the States disappears and is murdered in the Caribbean. That bit is 9.5 minutes long. It's not a 8-minute state of racial affairs in America followed by one catchy punchline. There's laughs every 15 to 30 seconds in that 9-minute bit.
Yeah.
Because and that's tough. That's hard to do. This is not me saying Chappelle's not capable of it, because he does it several times throughout his specials. Mm-hmm. But it's this idea of, like, when I see people and everybody, when I hear people calling the Emmett Till bit brilliant, I'm like, what? Brilliant as what? Not as comedy, because the punchline was there and you knew it was coming because he wasn't going to end on like a tearful note. And it's just, it's like civil rights history for dummies.
You know,
it's okay, but it's like, and I know it was like meaningful and interesting, but it was like, it's like, I feel like when people use, it didn't bother me watching it. It bothered that people were like singling it out as like the brilliant moment, because it's like, well, it's maybe one of the most memorable moments, but it was the least funny of the entire special. Yeah. Because it wasn't funny. It was it was like a history lesson with a punchline.
It's almost like if you had any type of Black history class, you'd know who Emmett Till was.
Right.
For mainstream America, I could see.
Yeah, great. He was also talking about the book that came out last year, mm-hmm. that where the woman, basically said, like, yeah, I lied. So yeah. There was obviously an update, a 2016 update to that.
Sure.
Or 2017, I should say. But to me, if you're going to tell a story like that, I need to hear more punchlines in it in a comedy special.
I mean, yeah, and I think it's preference. It's your preference, but you do.
But I would say the rest of the special does not follow that. Like, and then we get to the second special. And as Josh Homer reminded me online, the Iceberg Slim story.
It's old.
Which was just another. Which was just, I heard it was old, but I hadn't heard it. But it was also,
I hadn't either, but I just gleaned that from Josh.
A super long story that didn't make anybody laugh. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine, but when people kind of, my problem is when people highlight that as like, oh my God, a brilliant end to a brilliant special. I'm like, is it?
Is it?
I mean,
I like the money thing. The bag of 20 to 25 grand.
Sure.
I love the sexual, the stuff he talked about Louis and all that stuff. I thought that was some of my,
and like I said, my criticisms never are, nor are they here in content. Like what you're talking about. I have no problem with him bringing up Emmett Till in a comedy show. I have no problem with him talking about the Me Too movement or making fun of it or talking about pimps. Mm-hmm. None of the content offended me because, like I said, I'm not going to judge a comedian on what they do, but what they do with it. And that's what I'm saying is that what he... And it's not even, like I said, if I was going to grade these specials, like I would have given both like A minuses. So it's not like I'm trashing them. It's just, you know, as a comic, and this is one of the things that bothers me about the comedy world is that, you know, I had multiple people comment like, geez, we get it. You hated Chappelle's specials. And I'm like, this is what I hate about comedy. I'm in what it feels like a comedy chat room. So I'm not just saying, I liked it. I didn't like it. I'm offering some nuance and opinion for discussion or rebuttal. And if I offer a criticism about his closer and I then make a joke about it later, I am now a hater. Now I hated the special and I'm like shitting on stuff that people like. And it's like, this is one of the main things with comedy. It's like, you're either all in on the good side and you never critique, you never say anything wrong. You always back the right people. You always trash the right people. Or else you're like problematic or like a hater or like, you know, just think you're better than everybody, which I do, but you think, you know, shit like that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, well, you kind of brought up something that I think is interesting too. It's like this thing where it's, what's your term for black comics and white audiences?
Oh, the soul bounce.
It's like a soul bounce thing to where I've seen it on TV, and I don't want to get too into it, but it's sort of like I'm black and I'm a black comedian and I'm going to make white people feel guilty. I'm going to bring up things. I'm not saying Chappelle's doing that, but you're alluding to something that I've noticed that I've seen some black comedians do. It just doesn't feel right. I think it
maybe, look at the white lady in front row clutching her purse, but I ain't gonna steal it. All right, I got you.
Yeah, and it's just like, okay, now who are you? Because after you peel away the layers of your race and your sexuality, what's your story? Because people just seem to define themselves now as that, like, oh, I'm a cishet male. I'm a trans this. I'm a lesbian. I'm this. But who are you? What's your story? Like, and I feel like sometimes that's missing because it's just maybe. And I think maybe that's some shit that I think where it's just like, well, I'm a comedian. I'm black. I'm a big black dude. But let me tell you something that you might not know just by looking at me. Let me try to make you laugh in spite of my skin color, but just let that's already, you can already see that, but let me open up something. Let me open up. I don't know. I just kind of see people. I feel like sometimes when people do that, when they don't do that, they're hiding behind something else. And a lot of it, that shit becoming hack. Unless you're gonna improve on the design and do something new, in the words of the great Lupe Fiasco.
Of course.
That's just something that just kind of irks me because I saw 2 weeks in a row. I saw two people have different sets on late night where it was just like there's an awkward pause, and the audience just they kind of get it, but they don't. And it's like, I'm going to try to make white people feel guilty and you can't say anything because I'm black. And it's just fucking weird to me. I don't like it. I'm sorry. I don't fucking.
See, my problem that I've had my entire career and which I wish I'll tell stories on stage about, you know, like my black bouncer bit on Keep My Enemies Closer. Is just one example of many, like the white women disappears. Another, from my perspective, I try to bring, when not every joke, sometimes I'm making fun of things or talking about stuff, but like my perspective is unique in that it's like, well, I'm half black. And I said this not jokingly on my podcast, but in terms of how I'm treated, I said, I'm a white guy with a black father to mainstream America, which is its own perspective. I am half black, but unlike Obama, Obama is the first black president and only, you know, assholes sort of go half, but that's not how society has treated him, like a black dude.
It used to be that one drop, you was a nigger.
Right, and now it's almost like, and I laugh sometimes, I'm like, is it now because it's cool to be black that I don't, because I look the way I do, I don't suffer the police consequences or the people crossing the street consequences, so I haven't paid my dues to get any of the quote-unquote cool things about being black?
Right.
Like that it's cool, it's kind of, and it's like, I don't give a shit either way. But to me, it's more like, my perspective is unique in its own right from a racial diversity kind of standpoint. But as I said, I forget where, but I said, my face doesn't give good diversity.
And you talk about that in your act, though.
Right, but you can't throw, you know, I say, you know, when you look Italian, I could write a book called What White People Say When They Only Think There's a Giant Italian Dude Standing Nearby.
Mm-hmm.
But that, it's like, it's not, either I'm not good enough or it's not compelling enough, because in this mad rush for diversity, and that's my argument about diversity in comedy has always been, it is not a law firm. It is not a university. It is not a classroom. In comedy, stories, perspective, differences are important and like integral to the art, because you don't want nine dudes doing the same thing on stage. You want women. You want, I mean, I'm saying that just to be politically correct, but you want men of all races telling stories. And occasionally you even want to hear what a woman has to say. Preferably a lesbian who has a similar experience dating wise and socially to men, but you get what I'm saying.
I get it.
In all seriousness, it's like comedy is one of those things, just like literature, just like art to me, movies, music, the art is the easiest thing to me. If you're open-minded, certainly people can be closed-minded and reject things. And then you need to sort of open up opportunities. But to me, stand-up comedy is one of those things, like, if you were to just listen to 100 comics, good comics in the city, you're going, if you are an open-minded person, which not everybody is, I think you're going to end up with a diverse array. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to be like, well, I hadn't heard that kind of story or that kind of bit. So you'll get styles, you'll get backgrounds, you'll get that I think will be very different. And to me, I feel like, because I think comedy is very stupid, the comedy business, what I always see is at the club level, a lot of black headliners. Mm-hmm. And they've paid their dues. Some are young, some are old, some are famous, some are not so famous. But because the fan bases come out. And that's what you see. Like every time, like the last 2 years when I've done the clubs, you look at the Coming Soon, it has gotten blacker and blacker. Now, to me, that just says they've earned that, they have the fan bases, and that's that. So that's the marketplace at work.
And when you say
supporting that kind,
and when you say that,
the
we're
industry.
About, but wait. When we, and just for so the listeners know, when you're saying that's about like the improvs and the funny bones, right?
Funny, exactly.
Yeah.
And but then what you see is the industry, who are not pushing necessarily the ticket sellers, because the biggest white comics are already doing theaters and shit like that. You know, the Brian Regans, the Bill Burrs, they're beyond the club game already.
Right.
But when you look, it's a lot of the other headliners, a lot of the white headliners tend to be industry pushes. And also younger black comics, younger ethnic comics also tend to be industry push. Definitely. Whereas you see people that you can't explain why. It's like, well, you didn't sell the room out, so I don't know why you're the headliner. You papered. You sold out Saturday because Saturday always sells out, but you had to have paper tickets for Sunday and Friday. So I don't know what, but that's because industry pushes youth. They push looks, they push diversity, but they push it based on what they think they can extrapolate in terms of, I think this guy's going to be very hot. We want to like really start pushing him. Whereas when I go to the clubs, if it's an older act, it's almost definitely going to, it's more likely they're not going to be a black person because the dues have been paid there. But then, and we discussed this about a certain podcast where a very successful young white comic was talking about his show not getting picked up
right.
because he's a straight white guy. And then I thought to myself, is that the angle that you've been given 9 out of 10 cheat codes in the game? But what about the 14 black headliners I saw this year, none of whom have TV deals, even though they're selling out clubs solely on word of mouth and hard work? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, why shouldn't they be saying, where the fuck is my TV deal? I'm selling it. They don't have to paper this room.
Right.
And I'm selling out. So where's my TV deal? Why aren't they looking to me? Well, it's because they're looking at either the Comedy Central white faces or the Gerard, I'm going to say it, Gerard Carmichael's of the world, which you want to talk about. I do not get it. And I'm sorry to put the name out there because his brother is always fucking hot. Like every time I put his name in a post, his brother likes it. And I'm like, who the fuck are you? And where are you, dude? How are you getting Facebook alerts where you like every status I post about your brother? But he has put out 2 bad specials. And I don't like, and when he got it, this is, to me, he is the perfect example. I'm sorry for going on this, but he's a good example of proving that it's not just about white and black, that there's also a youth element to this. He's like 29 and he's had 2 HBO specials and they both sucked. But the new one, everybody is praising. And now I'm convinced there is PR behind that. Like, I don't know on what planet somebody could consider 8, the one he did this year, you know, in 2017,
right.
the best special of the year. Better, I mean, sounds like a...
First of all, it's not better than Roy Wood's special. It's not...
Of course not. But to rank that number one, I either think you're crazy, you don't understand comedy, or you have been bribed. And I don't mean that like, haha. Those are the only 3 options, that you are dumb/crazy, that you've never watched comedy, or that somebody paid you to put that number one. And he's made every top 10 list in like comedy best specials. And I look at that and I go, that's because they're not letting the market dictate. What they're doing is they're trying to anoint and catch the next big thing on the low end, you know, like a stock. They're trying to invest in Google before it's Google. Whereas these other things are already selling out these other acts are selling out clubs on the merits. But you're looking for the 25, 26-year-old. I thought this motherfucker was going to be Eddie Murphy when I watched his first special. And I mean that as I'm always open to liking new comedians. I think Bo Burnham is the genius of that generation. I really believe that. I think he is super smart and super sharp and super funny. A word that you never see Carmichael's specials get described as. I posted it on Facebook. It was interesting. It was honest. It was, they describe what he's wearing on stage. They say Parvati. Not once was hilarious, funny, or humorous in the entire review of an hour-long comedy special. And I said, this is one of the problems that I see with comedy. And when people talk about a comedy bubble, they always want to blame it on too many clubs and too many shows. No, the bubble's going to burst when they realize they've been promoting every 26-year-old with 8 minutes of material to do half hour and hours. And then people are going to go, comedy kind of sucks now. I'm as funny as this. I'm funny on my Twitter feed. Instead of all the right people getting promoted, like instead of a pure meritocracy, I think it's tipped beyond that. Because all the great specials, with the exception of somebody like a Mark Normand, who I thought his special was really good, and a Bo Burnham, I'm just giving you the people kind of under 35. Mm-hmm. All the great specials come from veterans.
Yeah.
Like, you correct me if I'm wrong, but all the great ones are from vets. Not just like, hey, this is his first thing and he exploded on the scene. It's like real veterans. So where's the young talent that's supposedly so great that you and I and other people are being held back from because there's just these important, brilliant voices? Because if Carmichael's the guy, you know, we're in fucking trouble. Because I want, like, you know, I just, the day, I didn't like this because I didn't want his brother liking the status, but you take out all the punchlines from Dave Chappelle's act and you're left with a Gerard Carmichael special. And I mean that completely seriously. As funny as it might sound, that's what it feels like watching. It feels like somebody who got a B in history telling me stories, and somebody who watched Patrice O'Neill and said, I can do that. even though I haven't lived that life, even though I'm young, I can be quote unquote honest and real. And it's like, where the fuck are the jokes? Where's the humor? If somebody wants to make a spoken word person the next superstar in comedy, they can do it. They just need money and clout, and you can make a superstar in comedy without comedy. But other than that, I think he's great. And I'm sorry for that long, long-winded rant.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's that's why you're the king of unpaid media, man. That's why you that's why people want you on their podcast. What always baffles me is the fact that last year I submitted to Comedy Central for a half hour, and I did not this year. Pardon me, felt like I did a set in South Jersey that was probably one of the best sets I'd ever done, like 27 minutes, in what could have been a not so good environment, and I had to turn the room around. I said, damn, I wish I would have recorded that. But even if I did and sent it in, it probably wouldn't have got picked. I see the people that are scrambling to put together half hours. I said, do you even have 10?
Yes, thank you. The half hour last year, I've tracked it. I submitted in 2014, 2016, and I submitted this year angrily. But I tape every set I do on the road. So I laugh sometimes. When I hear people going, I need to get a set. And I go, how do you not have a set?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to be aired, but I'm like, if you're on the road, like, how are you like in dire need of a set 2 weeks before the deadline?
They're not on the road. They're not doing the road. Come on.
And that's what's funny about this is that it's a weird environment because like last year, I remember my video, because it's private, you know, the YouTube link. So it's got 6 views, which means it was watched at Comedy Central, hopefully 6 times, which made me think maybe I made it past some preliminary level. Maybe I made it to round 2. You know, you try to talk yourself into being hopeful.
Yeah.
Because 6 views sounds like, hey, somebody must have given this like, hey, this is a top 50. And, you know, I have 200 or 500. This is the top 100. So let's give it another look. But the problem is, you know, the guy who's sort of managing me, but, you know, to be totally honest, not really. When he sent the email, of course, I got the email 4 days before the deadline, and he had the email since mid-October, so maybe I wasn't on the priority list to get it. But fortunately, I had, you know, 30 sets on my computer from 2017. Mm-hmm. And I sent a perfect set from Philadelphia with new material than last year. Obviously there's an overlap because it's a feature set. It's not like I'm doing a new album. So there was probably 15 minutes of overlap from the set I submitted last year. But I watched it and I was like, this looks great. It sounds great. The crowd's with me. There's some good ad libs and there's great material. But the management email from Comedy Central said, now just choose wisely when you're submitting clients, because what we're looking for is fresh, provocative voices who can have a future here at Comedy Central. That might as well just say 30 or younger, please. Mm-hmm. Like it just might as well say that, because the truth is I should have gotten I should be somewhere beyond a half hour, but whatever. It's money and it's an opportunity, but it's like a year older. It doesn't matter that the set's better or crisper. You know, it's just, I'm a year older. Like, so no matter how much better the set is, I honestly believe that I'm still competing for, like, you know, the guys 30 and under are competing for, you know, 12 of the spots. And I feel like 35 and over is competing for 3 to 4 spots. Mm-hmm. And it's tough because Comedy Central, you know, made their name on stand-up. And now they're kind of like MTV. Except instead of music videos, they're shying away from stand-up. Like, Netflix is buying up all the specials, and I know they can't compete with that. But, like, they don't even run stand-up presents anymore the way you used to. You know, you used to be able to turn on the middle of the day, and be like, hey, Dan Cook special. Oh, Patrice O'Neill, Jim Norton. Like, it was stand-up within the last 8 years. It was, like, heavy stand-up. And now it's all original programming. And I just feel like, shouldn't there be a respect still for what stand-up comedy is and developing talent? And I get it, it's a business, but like, it's like MTV doesn't play videos, and I think that's stupid. I haven't watched MTV in over a decade.
Were there a Viacom? Because this under the Viacom umbrella.
But, sure.
And what's interesting,
it just makes me...
Go ahead.
No, it's just frustrating because you're like, shouldn't you be trying... Shouldn't you want the best stand-up? And they don't. The answer is they don't. They will take the best if it fits into their other categories, but the quality of stand-up is not their highest priority. And I'm not, this isn't some dude going, we're all about diversity, man, because I don't think they're about that either. Like, I think they're about youth. I think they're about demographics, as if people who are 28 don't like great comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, I mean, do I need to do 15 minutes on Snapchat and carry a fidget spinner on stage to be like, hey, look at me, guys, I'm hip?
Maybe it's Netflix, where they aren't they doing like 15 minute specials now too, or something? They're doing
somebody told me.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody told me they're going to do 15, and it's like, to me, and it's old school of me, but like, I'd like to get a Comedy Central. Like, I'd like to, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I know I sound bitter and I'm always complaining, but like, I'd like to get a Comedy Central, but not because I think I feel I need no validation to the comedy world, mm-hmm. but I would like, as a, I don't know, a signpost or a landmark in my career that I got this, and I kissed no ass. I just made good comedy that they had to put on.
Right.
But I don't think that's, you know, I obviously, you know, I would bet against myself if I were in Vegas getting this.
Well, it's not like that's not understandable. There's things that I want to do. Dude, I want to do Whiplash. That shit doesn't pay. But that's always something that I saw people that were ahead of me that they've done. I want to do New Faces. I don't think that's happening. But the thing...
Unsigned is your better option. Because at least there's a hint of honesty there. Because now, I always find it funny. There's New Faces and then there's Unsigned. And I was like, well, how the fuck can these people be New Faces if they're already signed? But that's an unironic, you know... acknowledgement by Montreal of right, this has always been kind of a rigged game. Mm-hmm. So Unsigned is for people we just think are good at comedy, but New Faces is for people that managers really want to do this.
Dude, when I auditioned, so I auditioned for Montreal three times. The last time, the second time I made it to the second, first time I didn't make it to the second round, second time I made it. 3 years later, I get another audition. I killed. Nothing. And then I saw who got it. I was like, okay. And when I remember the day that I auditioned, I had already booked a part on Kimmy Schmidt. I had done a movie with Melissa McCarthy, but
yeah.
I'm not good enough to go to Montreal, like to them. Like, so it's almost like I want to do it. I don't think I need that, but it would be nice to do it. It would be nice to do a Conan. Yeah, everybody's doing it now, so they say. But it's like, fuck, man. I want to have Conan introduce me. I want to do a killer set. I want to shake that white man's hand after I kill it. Like, that's something that I want. But is that going to make me famous? I doubt it. But I feel the same way about the half hour. They're like friends of mine that have done it that I was like, wow, that's cool. I want to do that too. And I want just for yourself. But it just seems like the people that they pick, I'm not shitting on. I know some of them. But it's like, do they really?
I'll shit on some.
Do they? It's like, I just wonder, like, the people that are doing it, it's like, do you have the time? I'm not saying I'm Patrice, but fuck, I got time.
Yeah,
I can entertain people for a good for a long time for over an hour.
Right, I feel this is not. It's like, it's kind of comical at this point, but I was gonna say you know, I almost posted on Facebook. I was going to write, and you'll laugh at the arrogance of this. I was going to write Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, J.L. Covan. Are there three more prolific masters of the art of comedy? Except one of these guys doesn't jerk off in front of women, and one doesn't make fun of trans people. But I was going to, like, to me, if they gave me a half hour, if they gave me a month, I could be like, okay, I can do a completely new hour because I have so much fucking material backed up from years of hustling and trying to make a name for myself. But to me, it's people view the half hour, and this is partly, I think, the fault of Comedy Central. It's now not a landmark in your career. It's a stepping stone. It's the same way I felt when Letterman a few years ago, like right after Eddie Brill got fired. Mm-hmm. I felt like Letterman, you know, when I would see a comic like John Fish do Letterman after, you know, let's say 13 years or 14 years, you'd go, well, look at that.
He worked
hard. That's a nice accomplishment for like one of the lower, like a guy that all the comedians know, but that most people don't know, but that he's put in the time, he can put together a quality late night set that isn't like him working on material. But then all of a sudden it became a thing where I saw a lot of guys doing very mediocre spots. And some have attained very high levels of fame. And
it's fascinating.
It became a thing where it was like, wait a second, this was supposed to be I've arrived, not like, hey, I've got a new client that's really on the rise. You think we can get him on Letterman or Leno or, you know, Fallon? Now it's more like, yeah, fuck it. Let's see what they got. Whereas I thought it was like, no, you can't bomb a late night set or you can't do mediocre when these things are like the Kingmaker shows. And then I was just seeing set after set that I was like, C plus, A minus. Okay. Good for you, person who did that. But then a lot of just kind of like, I did my first and only real late night spot 10 years ago and I crushed it because that's what you're supposed to do. It's 4.5 minutes. It's not a half hour when you have 26 minutes of material and you've got to stretch and find a way. If you don't have 5 minutes after doing it for a few years or many years, what the fuck are you doing? If you're just kind of okay. And I remember people writing things about, you know, every time somebody gets a late night set, there'll be some blog about, well, here's what I did, and people will share it and love it. And some nice people have done these, but it's like, but expect it. And I remember one in particular was even expect it to be, you know, corrected and you'll have to edit your set and they'll want you to edit again. And then you go back and forth. I had 6 words taken out of 1 joke on the set I submitted to Ferguson. That's it. I don't get, like, I just genuinely don't understand, like, and this obviously deals with some of my frustration of being a nobody in comedy, but it's like, I don't get it. I can't, you know, either I'm a misunderstood genius or this whole industry is full of shit.
It's a little bit of both, man. I think I'm not blowing smoke. I think you're a great comic, man. You're a friend, and I don't hang around with whack motherfuckers. You know, I don't ask whack. I don't ask whack people to do my show, and I would hope that you feel the same way about me. But
that you're a whack motherfucker?
No.
Kidding.
No. But it's just I think we both still
just have, like, Patrice O'Neill has 2 albums with me introducing him.
Yeah,
you are on 2 albums introducing me. Okay, that is the rich legacy that you are part of.
Yeah, man. I'm glad to be on them, man. I find I have the frustration too a lot. I mean, I don't talk about it on Facebook, but I just. I think now, like, when you start to get stuff and things start to happen, like, there's definitely validation. And I felt that last year, even though there's still an upward climb, you know, I still wish I would have got that part on, I auditioned for Broad City 4 times, did not get on, one part that I auditioned for, I saw that they gave it to somebody else who was in the already in their pipeline. And I was all right. I see how it is. I wanted to be on that show because it's so fucking fun. Like the scenes that I was involved in were so funny. Like I think that's a funny show. It's like a funny ass show. And so part of me, I wanted that Comedy Central credit. Yeah, it's like three or four lines, but I wanted to do that. I want to play. I'm an actor. And so that shit just like, it's just like, okay, all right. I still want that part as the bartender on The Blacklist. You know what I mean? So it's just that thing, man. And you just have to keep going. And you're doing it in a righteous way. Like you want it for all the right reasons. It's not necessarily I think sometimes you say like, oh yeah, when I get this, I think everybody feels that way. If I book this, I'm going to tell everybody to go fuck themselves. But I think at some
point. Oh, no, it's beyond that. I'm going full John Wick I ever make it.
Because I've heard.
Yeah, that. It's just.
Go ahead.
No, it's just, it's going to be horrific. It's going to be the baptism scene from The Godfather.
I've heard Bill Burr say, like, I don't know if you remember that story where he talks about flying himself out to do some Showtime audition in L.A., and he shat on the crowd because it was only four or five people there. And he talked shit about that. And he said, like, one, the dude was like, man, you shouldn't have talked about the fact there were no people there. I still could have, you know, booked you off of the set that you gave, man. He was like giving him shit. And then Burr was like, I'm paraphrasing, he said, you know, when I make it, I'm going to tell that guy to go fuck himself. And then he saw that dude years later and he was just like, why? Why would he even do this? Why would he even say that to him? Is it even a fucking point? There's been people that won't respond to my messages to try to get booked. There's people that have deleted me off of Facebook, like for friend, like bookers that have done that. And we can talk about that later. And it's just like, but like you're supposed to be for controversial, not necessarily like for people that really speak their mind and talk about real shit. But I'm deleted from his account. I'm deleted. You delete me. But okay, mm-hmm. Like, I never did anything to that dude. So it's just kind of like, okay, this is what it is. I see what you put on stage. I see the people that you put on stage all the time, and it's the same people. And so be it. Like I have to like just make peace. Part of it is just me making peace with myself. And just saying, well, I have to find another way. I guess I can't do that show in a certain place upstate New York anymore. Or I can't do that bar show in the cool little room because of whatever reason you have, you know.
Right.
So, but it makes me mad. I'm not going to say that I don't get mad about it. But we got to. You got to move on, I guess. I don't know.
MoveOn.org.
Yeah, man. So we kind of lost. We kind of moved on. I guess we've moved on past.
Yeah, it started as Chappelle, and yeah. I like I said, because the thing with me and Chappelle is, I do think, for instance, when he says, and I'll admit I laugh, but when he says fag or faggot. Now, when Bill Maher, and I don't think it's different, and Rod, I think, made this point sort of in a meme, but, you know, when he used it under the trans, you know, because it was in the trans bit, but, you know, if Bill Maher says, house nigger, like, and he's not calling someone that, but he's using a loaded term,
right.
Thinking he's being funny, there's no difference between that and Chappelle calling a transsexual a fag. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of it should be equal outrage or not outrage. Like, it should, if you were offended by one, the other should be considered offensive or out of bounds. And if you're not, then they're both okay, would be my take. But at first, like I said, I really I generally don't criticize content. To me, I criticize funny. Like I said, it's not what you say. It's not what you say. You're allowed to say anything, but how you say it determines whether it's funny or not. And I thought it was funny. My only criticism was I felt like, and it was more a reaction to the way people reacted to him, was why is this 8-minute story with one punchline that was sort of telegraphed so amazing? Like, you know, I don't think they were perfect specials. I think they were really funny. And I think the state of comedy as it is, the more we see from veteran comics who grew up, came up the hard way or the right way, I might call it, because it's the way I was taught and have failed with, which is do material, keep doing material, keep working. Like Dave Chappelle didn't have to worry about social media. Brian Regan, Bill Burr, these guys have reaped rewards since because they were already established people. But there's no comic over the age of 42 whose career was not made before social media. Like that, they just made it on repetition, work, being professional, and producing good comedy. Now it's like, so now you see all these specials and you're like, that was okay. That was okay. And then, oh my God, Dave Chappelle, amazing. Roy Wood, amazing. And Roy Woods was really good.
Yeah.
But like, I genuinely, outside of Bo Burnham, and this is me genuinely asking, not like being a dick, I want to know what are the great specials out there from comedians under the age of 35? Because plenty of them are getting work. You know what I mean? Like plenty of them are getting TV spots and gigs and work and whatnot. But I just want to know where is the great work from the comedians under 35.
I can't think of any. I mean, I would have to give, I need to give, look at Michelle Wolf's special again.
How old is she?
I think she might be 32, maybe.
Okay. And I have, yeah, that's on demand. I will watch that because I heard it was very good. Although,
last year when the whole, how people would come to me, like even you, like would text me, like, did you fucking hear what this person said on this podcast about da 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 da? And like other people like message me and stuff about it. And I'm like, fuck. And I was like, and I saw somebody on Facebook that had been on Conan twice that had had a half hour and was saying, oh, you have to be black to be successful. And I said, like, I think I said it. I did say it at some point last year when all that was bubbling. I said, taking myself out of the equation. There's people that I know that are above me as far as achievements, and they haven't crossed over to the next level. But motherfuckers like you, motherfuckers like this person, white guy comic, you're in their fucking way, and you're not that good. Like, you've been lucky.
It's a very quick path from, and the only thing that I would say, since I always sound so bitter, the only thing I will say about having a long road so far in comedy without achieving what I want is that I will have earned my sense of earning it. You know what I mean? Like, no one will be able to look at me and go, oh, he thinks he made it on hard work. Yes, because 15 years means that 15 years of anonymity, except for what I got on my own, is earning it the hard way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think sometimes I see people who it's like, I feel like they talk themselves into, I had an exchange with the, remember when there was, comedy always has these very insular big stories that mean nothing to anybody else?
Of course.
And it was when UCB was not paying their performers. Mm-hmm. And I took their side. I was just like, I'm on the road getting paid the same shit that my counterpart in 1988 was getting paid. So I don't know why you guys are complaining about a 10-minute spot at UCB when they only charge people $5. Like, to me, I took it as, oh, UCB, the show's only $5, so you probably get more audience charging that than like 15 or 20 a ticket. Mm-hmm. So there's the trade-off. Like, they got to make their money, right?
Yeah.
And then people are like, no, that's, you've got to pay. You don't perform if they don't pay. And I'm like, that's a wonderful thing to think in the age of podcasts and tweets and YouTube and like, where like now you think you have all these platforms, like you don't need the you don't need their stage time. It's like, because you're not looking at this as a stand-up comic. You're looking at this as somebody who is going to like manipulate and gain their way into being a stand-up comic through all the other outlets available. But I said, I don't, you know, and I made a comment, like a thinly veiled attack at some beard, you know, some of the more famous New York bearded comics whose careers exploded after Zach Galifianakis became the template for 2 years. And one, and you can, I'm sure you could off the bat name the exact two that I'm referencing, but one of them wrote me a private message. And he was somebody that I found to be funny. So it's not like I'm taking a shit on him, but he said, I was featuring for a year and a half straight before. Sorry, Cookie's going nuts. Cookie, come here, Cookie. Sorry. He said, I've been featuring for a year and a half straight before I started headlining, so I know what it's like. And I didn't respond to that because I was like, this is the mentality. I've been featuring for, first of all, I haven't featured for a year and a half straight. I can't get enough gigs to feature for that many. You know, for, I can't. I have 2-3 months with nothing. Then I have like 2-3 months of like 3 weeks of work per month. Then I go 2 more months. So without an agent just booking me and leveraging their bigger clients to get me consistent work, I don't even get that. And I've been doing it. I've been featuring at clubs since 2010. So like, but the mentality is like, hey, you know, you pay your dues with a couple of years of feature at most, then you're a headliner. Then you get a writing gig. So don't tell me I don't know what it's like. And I was just like, this is the mindset now. This is the kind of, you know what it's like if you've had, if two of your friends became headliners and you didn't get to headline till your third year, you struggled.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, I don't even want, like, that perspective is very stupid. And people start to really think that they've earned it when it's like, nope, you were still on the fast track. Yeah, congratulations. Enjoy your success. Enjoy your riches. Enjoy and hopefully make the most of your opportunities. But stop acting like, you know, it's that. And this is why, you know, one of my favorite things from Mike Payne, a guest on my podcast, was when he said, and I've repeated it because he said it off, you know, while we weren't recording, but he said, every comic is like Karl Marx when it comes to the world. You know, just everything's got to be equal. Corporations are slime. The wealthy are disgusting. And then in comedy, they become Paul Ryan, where as soon as they've gotten anything, it was because they earned every bit of it. And everyone who isn't successful has not earned it and has not worked hard enough.
Right.
It becomes a very self-reinforcing philosophy. As soon as I get something, it's because I worked harder and am better. And if you don't have something, no matter how good you are, how much you've worked, it's actually because of a flaw in you and not the system that has made me so rich and successful.
Yeah.
And it's really the height of irony because comedy is a fairly liberal place. Mm-hmm. And inside comedy, they become, you know, strong Republicans.
Oh, definitely. I mean, see it all the time. And it's just, it just baffles me, and I go back to the scrambling to do half hours. It's like, can you go to Toledo and make these people? Can you make them laugh? They don't know who you are. You're not billed. You're not the headliner. Can you go make them laugh? I mean, I did a show New Year's Eve and had to deal with people having noisemakers before the show. I get on stage. And I was like, hey, guys, you know, and then I was like, okay, can't you do the noisemakers, can't use the noisemakers through the show because, you know, it's, you know. And I knew I was going to have to deal with that. I told the headline, I was like, I'm probably going to have to deal with this. I'm going to have to talk about it, and I'm going to be an asshole because I say something. So they stopped, and then it was one person that blew the noisemaker, like, wah! And I was like, I said, there's always one asshole. There's always one asshole, and now you guys are getting quiet, and you're getting tight because I mentioned it. And then I just continued with my set, and I did 40 minutes. But it's like, yep. I don't know, like, I don't know that a lot, not saying like, I don't know that anybody else could deal, but it's just, you have to deal with all those other things and do comedy.
With the half hour, what I find so funny about it, and I made this point in a long post, where I basically said, they're asking for 30 to 35 minute tapes. The load, you get a half hour if you're super lucky,
right?
But you get 20 to 25 minutes to feature. Because if you're a headliner, if you're a legitimate headliner, what the fuck do I care about a Comedy Central half hour? Mm-hmm. Like I mean, I'm going to look for an hour or another outlet. That's that entry level headliner kind of phase.
Yeah.
So the clubs will give you 20, maybe 25. Now it so happens, hearing them, I've worked a lot, and they gave me a little extra, and I ended up actually blowing a light, which I really almost never do. But I did a 34-minute set, one of my sets in Philly, and nobody complained, and I crushed. But I was, you know, when I look back on it, I was thankful, but I was also embarrassed. I was like, that's not usually me. Like, I'm not a light-blowing, like, a-hole. Right. But nobody had a problem with it, and it just so happened I had a set that comported, and I loved it. It was the set I submitted this year.
Okay.
But I laugh when I see people going, I'm filming my half hour, and I made this point in the post. I'm filming my half hour tonight. Please come see it. And it's like, this is what Comedy Central wants? Artificial half hours? And I'm not criticizing anybody who does it, because I said, how can I criticize you when this is the way you can do it? Mm-hmm. I'm doing 30 to 35 minutes at this place with one other friend of mine. Please, everybody, come out. What I did was I did my set in front of 200 strangers in Philadelphia. Now, yes, there's a CD, a merch pitch, 32 minutes into my set, because I'm taping at a real comedy club.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a real show working as a comic. I'm not kind of saying, I need 100 of my friends to flood this place, laugh your asses off, make me look like a killer. I'm not saying this is what people do, but that's basically what people are doing.
That's what
I have, you know, I have 200 fans nationwide. I'm making a joke, but, you know, who knows how many? 300, 150. But those have been fans I've earned through albums, Spotify, Pandora, performing, podcast appearances. Every fan I have has been earned.
Right.
A lot of these people do not have fans, and I don't say that as an insult. How could you have fans? I've been on TV. I've been on Corolla 8 times, Black Eyed Tips a bunch, performed around the country at clubs multiple times over the years, and I barely have a fan base. So how could you have fans? If you've never done anything, you'll have friends, and that's cool. You'll have some strangers, and that's cool. But they're going to, like, the Comedy Central is like, give us your half hour to 30 or 35 minute performance. It's like, that's a time that does not exist in professional stand-up comedy.
But do you think some of that's a formality for the people that they kind of, it's like a dog and pony show? They already know who they're going to pick?
Yes. Like, well, I think they've already had some people on Adam Devine's house party that, like, mm-hmm. Then we'll get it. And I don't mean that like in other words, but if you fit either a demographic that they are lacking in, or if you are an undeniable killer, you get one of the four veteran spots. And everybody else would just be a rainbow coalition of millennial approved demographic comedians.
Right.
So if you are just a powerhouse act and or a demographic they need, they will dip into that 35 and older. And that's not me denigrating somebody who might be, whether it be an Asian man, a black woman, a Latin woman, a gay man, whatever. That's not me saying that they're not good enough, but that they might double dip then and say, ooh, this person's a killer and they fit what we're missing. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to that 30 and under or 32 and under group, I think you're going to see. Because to me, I'm laughing at the list now, because 4 years ago I said, okay, I have to submit for this now, because now they're dipping into the people I know and think are my equals.
Yeah.
It's been years since that happened. Like, now I'm looking at people going, who the fuck are these people?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
No, mostly. Not all the time. Like, obviously, the names I read. But usually, now postseason, it used to be I knew 11 of 13 names. Now I know, like, 2 of 18 names. So it's like, it's now past me, like, as a generation. Like, nobody I know is even getting it. Not because I'm, because I don't know the new people coming up.
Yeah.
They've already moved past, like, my age group and friend group. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. We just got to keep plugging away. You put out a video. I was surprised by that.
Well, I forgot some, and it's gotten almost no views, which is fine, because it was
I put it on my channel. It's funny. It's a funny video. Talk about it a little bit.
Oh, it's because I like the show Vikings on History Channel. It's a pretty big hit show as far as TV, you know, it's got like 5 million viewers, which for TV now is pretty big, especially on basic cable. So I thought, well, this is an idea that I remember when I was at a job a couple of years ago, I was making one of my coworkers laugh by making fun of the show, like how they talk. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know what? This year I'm going to do a mix because I have some big budget ideas that I'm going to have to bring in Dana and Juan, my erstwhile team, to make. And those will cost me money and not cheap, but good quality. And I have some ideas that I really think could go viral. But I'm also going to do kind of some homemade videos because my two biggest hits since the Louis C.K. video 4.5 years ago have been homemade videos, just like voiceover videos or like my Gordon Hayward one got 40,000 views. And that was just like me bitching in a camera. And then my Trump Eminem rap got like 230,000 views and counting. And that's the second most I've ever gotten for any video. And it took me an hour. In my apartment, no budget, no crew, nothing.
And you wrote all those bars too.
Yes, I did. Thank you. Take that, Black Sauce.
I don't know about that, buddy. Yeah. You're a great comic, but rapper, you are not, buddy. You're good. You're good.
But
I know you're trolling. Though. I know you're trolling.
Yes. That's okay. But my next big budget one, I can give the listeners a preview, is going to be called This Is Trump.
Okay.
And it's going to be a parody of the NBC show showing Trump as a new father and then as president. And, you know, that will be, I have to, you know, that's going to take budget and I hope to get it out sometime in late February.
Okay.
But that's going to be great. I know that. Now, the question is, does it get 3,000 views or does it get, you know, 2.5 million? But that's one that we like a big budget. But for instance, my John Bernthal acting school / Punisher web series will be low budget. But I am going to next Saturday get a haircut. Where I asked the barber at 8:30 in the morning, please just cut the sides. I'll be back in 8 hours for you to finish the haircut. And that is a fact. Oh, that is actually what I'll be doing. Now, could those become little hit videos? Because I know there's already like enthusiasm from Rod and his fan base for that impression. Mm-hmm. So that could catch on and be a low budget thing that costs me no money except like a Punisher t-shirt.
Yeah.
And an extra $5 in barbershop tip. But could I get 100,000 views from that? Maybe. So the Vikings video is just making fun of how they speak on Vikings and kind of the brutality of the culture. And it was goofy and I actually kind of enjoyed it. I'm disappointed that it's gotten so few views. But, you know, I didn't expect it to be a hit. It was more like I'm hoping it is. And if not, at least it's something goofy that I like.
Yeah.
So, you know, this year I've outlined a list of things for this year in comedy that, you know, new album, 8 new videos that I'm going to do. And I'm also, you know, you talked about going to your show earlier in this podcast, like going to a show and feeling like I need this. Well, my New Year's resolution sort of, but also it's something I've needed to do for a while, is really to hit the gym hard and to really watch my diet because I'm tired of being out of shape. I used to be in fantastic shape, and I've just sort of settled into kind of a burly, you know, I used to be built like, do you watch This Is Us?
Yeah, I've seen it before. You are.
I went from Kevin to Toby for fans of the show. I used to be built like a taller Kevin. Now I'm built like a slightly less fat Toby.
I'm built like Patrice O'Neal with none of the talent. So I have to get back in the gym. I feel the same way. Like I was never the Rock shape, but I could look back at myself when I was in my 20s. I still thought I was fat. I was good looking. I was hot. And it's like, who the fuck was that guy? But I think it was some mom shit where it's like, oh, you're fat, you know, it's just like, mom. You know. So that, yeah. that's some shit there too, but yeah, man.
But I'm gonna play in the fall. Now this is a ways off, but this is going to be my next "I dare you not to hire me" video to SNL, which of course they won't. But I'm going to lose, like I'm going to hit the gym hard, build up the muscle, and lose at least 50 pounds in the next 5 to 7 months, and then I'm going to do a series of Dwayne Johnson presidential ads and do a Dwayne Johnson versus Donald Trump presidential debate. Like I'm going to get early on that and establish myself once again as the premier Trump, but also the early front runner for the Dwayne Johnson impersonator, just as a way of saying, keep hating haters, but you know, I'm good.
So the one thing that's good about this is it doesn't seem like your love for creating has died. Because I know I heard you on the Black Guy Who Tips a couple weeks ago. Where it was like, I'm going to quit. And they were like, no, JL, don't quit. I might.
Can I tell you what's inspired while you're making me sound like a cuck? What inspired me, and this is going to sound funny, but I'm halfway through a biography on Ulysses S. Grant. Which, by the way, somebody, maybe if Randolph is listening, please tell President Obama to stop cheating off of my book recommendations from my podcast. Because he had multiple books on his list that I was talking about months ago. And I'm like, you can't do that, man. Half black actors.
We know we know he didn't take any of your rap choices.
No, he did not. I didn't even look at his music choices.
I know.
But Ulysses S. Grant was a, you know, I keep writing like little updates about him, but he was like a general in the Civil War who just kept winning. Everybody thought he was like a drunk loser, but he then won the Civil War, became a two-term president who was like, basically, not until Lyndon Johnson did a president do or try to do as much for black people as he did. Because people forget, history has rewritten him in some ways as a piece of shit, because the people writing history right after him were like, yeah, we want Jim Crow. And this motherfucker was trying to get them rights.
Can you rattle off that Lyndon B. Johnson quote? It's almost like it's like white people need niggers or some shit. What is it? Do you remember?
I don't know it by heart, but I know he says nigger three times. Basically his point was just basically like, you know, politicians come down here and yell nigger, 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 and then you vote against what's good for you.
Yeah.
Like, it was something like that.
Right.
And it was bold as fuck. Mm-hmm. And I know he's not perfect, and like Vietnam is his albatross historically, but like this dude, I've always joked, I'm like, I feel like the only two presidents historically, and I might have to add Grant in there as well, because Frederick Douglass loved Grant as well. Okay. Lincoln and maybe LBJ, they might get like a day-long pass to say the N-word. Because Lyndon Johnson, I mean, this dude basically turned the South over to racist whites politically after that, because that's how far, like how much he put to advance civil rights. He was politically calculating. Yes, I'm sure he was sort of a bigot from Texas, but the results don't lie. Mm-hmm. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what do you say? Like, hey, but he used to say this. Look what he did.
Yeah.
And with Grant, he got the 15th Amendment through. he was pro arming ex slaves. He was like against slavery. He was, you know, the only woman he ever cheated on his wife with, and it's only a possibility, was a Native American woman when he was away from his wife for years. I'm like, look at that. He was even woke with his mistress choices. His wife was ugly as fuck, but he said when she wanted to get her lazy eye fixed, no, this is not, when she wanted to get her lazy eye, like surgery for her lazy eye, he said, isn't that the face I fell in love with? Please do not change it. This face belongs to me and I love it. Like, that's some Nicholas Sparks shit. You know, The Ugly Ass Wife by Nicholas Sparks, starring Ulysses S. Grant. But the reason this book has inspired me, long story short, is this dude was a business. He had a few little successes and then was a total business failure. And then the Civil War broke out when he was, guess the age, 38. And then the dude became, 15 years later, the dude's president.
So like, you're going to have the same arc?
Well, what I'm saying is Donald Trump is on getting us on a way to a civil war. So that part's handled. All I have to do is become president in like 2030.
JL, I don't know what the proper nickname I can give you. Maybe it's like Mr. Everything. Because you can wedge yourself into every... every situation.
Well, it bothers me, and I know it's kind of a compliment, but Ryan Gurian, a.k.a. RG Daniels, he will always say, how do I know you had a video for this topic? But it's because I'm prolific that I'm always able to sort of be like, yeah, boom, there you go. I say that not like just put my head on top of a wedge salad for my logo. I don't say that because I think I'm going to be president, obviously, but it was the kind of book where you're like, holy shit, man, this dude just lived a fairly righteous life. And then when opportunity came upon him, he rose to the occasion and, you know, did good things.
Yeah. Well, Jay,
but I recommend that book. It's going to take, you know, 8 weeks of my life to read, but it's very dense and very good.
It's called Grant.
Just Grant, yeah, by Ron Chernow. Same guy who wrote Hamilton. He won a Pulitzer for... It's the fourth book of his that I've read now. He won a Pulitzer for his biography on George Washington. He wrote one on John Rockefeller. Like, he's a very, you know, obviously widely respected biographer. But Grant... I think Grant is so interesting because it's, like, kind of a famous but, like, less famous, if there's a way to say it. Like, for a guy who did so much... He seems like less important than he should be. Mm-hmm. Like, dude won the Civil War and there was a 2-term president during Reconstruction. Like, it was the only time between the Civil War and the 1960s when basically the federal government was like making an earnest, hard push to give black people full American rights.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'm reading that I need to start reading? Let me pull it out. It's the, got it from Barnes & Noble. The Actor's Life, A Survival Guide by Jenna Fisher from The Office.
Oh, nice.
Oh, my pedestrian reading. I need to get back to reading, dude. I need to read this. I want to read Coates. I read a lot of articles that just kind of make me angry, but I need to get back into reading books. I used to be a voracious reader. You had to read a bunch being in law school and then undergrad on that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we'll wrap this up. We're going to talk some shit about some movies on the other end. So JL, plug some more of your stuff. The podcast is coming back.
Podcast will be back on Tuesday. The Righteous Prick podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic. Nothing. I'm going to headline the Albany Funny Bone this Wednesday.
Nice.
But it's, you know, it's not to shit on it, but it's between you and I and your listeners. It's, you know, like a friend has independently produced a successful like monthly show there, so he wanted me to headline it. So it's still, it's nice. It's not, but of course, it's once again, it's the outsiders kind of providing me the opportunity, not the industry.
I would say, I don't think there's a Cheesecake Factory there.
Oh, there is.
Oh, there is? Okay, because I was going to say if there wasn't one, you should check out the Standard that's in that mall, I believe.
Yeah, my thing is I'm gonna go to the Cheesecake Factory for the salmon, and I'm going to try and skip the cheesecake because now I'm not kidding, and it's the weirdest thing, but the idea for me is by this summer, I want to be able to, you know, I found it funny when I said I was going to play The Rock in some sketches later this year, and somebody wrote, you're going to have to put on like 70 pounds of muscle. And I was just like, well, I'm not trying to be The Rock. Like, if I could do that, I'd just become The Rock then. If I could just become 280 pounds of ripped muscle, I'll just do that.
Yeah, no, you don't have to.
I'm just trying to play him in a sketch. All I have to do is look bigger than the dude next to me.
Just be a reasonable facsimile. Don't kill yourself. Well, JR, go ahead. You got anything else?
Oh, I'm sorry. And I guess, I don't know, just if people are inclined, there's a lot of good videos. There'll be some new stand-up clips, a lot of new sketch videos coming. That, at least, I can promise. I'd say subscribe to youtube.com/JLCAUVIN. And my website will be brand new by the end of this month. It'll be a brand, same web address, but like a wholly reconfigured design and look. So I guess that's some good stuff.
That's great, man. Thank you for your time, JL. And you can also catch JL. We're talking movies on the Patreon side. So enjoy and take it easy, everybody.